if you go back to what was expected in markets in March and where we are today, we've got a lot more tariffs. We've got a lot more uncertainty. We've certainly got a lot more geopolitical conflict. And yet you look at the markets and everything's fine. And honestly, I think it's a gift to client portfolios, getting the opportunity to make adjustments, to get more diversified, to get more resilient.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for being here. It's been about a month since we last heard from you in the Daily Observations, right after Secretary Bessent announced mutual tariff reductions for the US and China. And since then, a lot has happened across many of the themes that you've been writing about and commenting on in the BDO throughout the year. We've had major developments on tariffs. We've had the One Big Beautiful Bill advancing through Congress. We've had obviously significant developments in terms of geopolitical risk and a lot more. And then this is all heading into President Trump's July 9th deadline for trade deals to be made, after which we could see additional tariffs being imposed. So we thought this would be a great time just to sit down with you for a conversation, get your thoughts on how you're processing all of these events in the context of the big picture dynamics that you've written about. So maybe let's just start at the highest level. As you look out today at the world, what are the biggest things on your mind?
Yeah, well, it's a good time because there's so much to talk about. So, I mean, first off, I would start with, I think the work that we've done on what we think modern mercantilism looks like has continued to play out. So this is kind of the main theme. It's messy in terms of the application of any particular set of principles as you look at what's going on in the U.S. administration today. But the basic picture that the goal of most of the economic policies are to use the economy to strengthen the U.S., strengthen kind of the government, strengthen the working class in the U.S., those things continue to move forward, and the implications of those things continue to move forward. And we're really at a critical time here. We're going to go into the July 9th date. And, you know, our basic view is that you'll continue to see the push towards further tariffs. We've learned a lot in the last couple months about the pain tolerance of the Trump administration. But I would say the big picture is the overall view of how the world works hasn't changed. And so what you're likely to see in our view in July 9th is a push wherever the Trump administration feel they can towards higher tariffs. And while they've learned how dependent the U.S. economy is on China for certain things, in other cases where the U.S. isn't as dependent on other economies, I think you're going to see stronger than the market's currently expecting push on tariffs and the continuation of the basic policies of the Trump administration, which is to push back, right? And again, just step back and look at the world. U.S. mercantilism, the fact that Trump's president, is in part a reaction to mercantilism in China, the growth of China, the implications that's had on the U.S. economy, the U.S. middle class, and so on. And now you've got U.S. mercantilism, and that's now flowing in to have even more implications in the rest of the world. And of course, there's more than just the tariff part of that picture. There's the geopolitical part of that picture. You've got Russia, Ukraine, you've now got Israel, Iran. We'll see exactly where that plays out in the next couple of days. And you've got the growth of China, the implications in Asia for that growth and the hardening of positions along those lines as well. I think it matters for financial markets. I think there are risks of tail events that are significantly larger than they have been on average over the last 40 years. There always are, but they are large and it's dangerous. And as an investor, and certainly the way I'm thinking about all our portfolios is, boy, how do you stay resilient? How do you hedge out as much of these risks as possible? So a lot going on in terms of geopolitical conflict. The rules are changing on how the global order works at a time when investors are so massively overinvested in the U.S. relative to GDP share or any kind of way you would look at how much you'd want to be invested in the U.S. economy if you looked at it more like a normal economy in the world. And so you're starting to see, in our view, both, I'd say, look at the data, although I'd say the data is arguable, but look at the data, you're seeing major institutions across the world pulling back from buying U.S. assets. You're seeing that most directly in the dollar, which is most clearly implicated as global investors pull back from their investments in the U.S. And more generally, we think it's a long-term risk to U.S. financial assets. That's happening at a cyclical time. So when we go into our kind of bread and butter of what's happening cyclically. It's been interesting, right? I did think the new policies, trade policies, and otherwise would cause more of a freeze in the US and global economy than it has. But you're starting to see some of that play out, right? So the economy didn't slow as quickly. Corporate activity remained relatively strong. Corporate profits remains very strong. Corporations have not cut back on CapEx all that much. The AI push and the need for the raw materials of AI, the chips, the power, those things continue. I think what you're seeing, as I would expect, is that most of the major players believe that it is existential. They still have cash. They have big balance sheets. They have the ability to continue to do significant CapEx. And you are seeing that. And I think that will continue to accelerate. But you're starting to see more indications in the US, in the UK, in Canada of growth weakening in the hard data. And we do think it's not going to be, at least this phase will be a slowdown below potential, probably not quite to recession levels, but a slowdown at a time when the Fed is kind of stuck. The Fed's stuck for a couple of reasons. Most importantly is the uncertainty around the inflation picture. When tariffs start to show up more in the core inflation numbers, which we expect in the next couple of months, will that push inflation to levels that makes it hard for the Fed to ease? On top of that, the fiscal bump that's coming in the US is significant. And if you're the Fed and you're thinking about maybe do I cut rates or do I wait to let the fiscal bump play its part in the early part of next year, that's going to make it more complicated. So we think the Fed's going to be stuck. I'd say Powell's comments generally lean towards the kind of the least risky thing to do is wait. And so we think the Fed will be waiting into a global economic slowdown. Now, the rest of the world is less constrained. We think overall, although this is not 100% certain by any means, but overall that the trade implications of the US tariffs and such are disinflationary for the rest of the world as there's some degree of dumping of things that would have normally come into the US on top of the cyclical growth hit that those things are causing and the uncertainty that they're causing. So you're starting to get a slowdown, and I think it'll be a disinflationary slowdown more clearly. So we do expect policymakers in the rest of the world to move quicker. And of course, which levers they pull will matter a lot. There's, to some degree, we expect reasonable movement in monetary policy across the world, potentially some easing of quantitative tightening across the world, which has had implications on the long end of the yield curve. At the same time, you might not get as much of that as you normally do, because in a lot of cases, there'll be a significant fiscal response. Certainly, you need military buildouts in a lot of places that haven't had military buildouts in a while. You're seeing a push in Canada and some other places for a fiscal policy to offset some of the negatives from the US trade policy. And so you're seeing more proactive fiscal than you usually do at this point in a slowdown. And so that's another part that complicates the picture when it comes to rates, particularly on the long end. Then, the other big question and the huge research that we've been working on is how to think through the deficit picture, and how much government debt is too much and where are the limits. I've been doing a lot of digging on this, Jake, trying to see are we missing anything? Because I do think we have a somewhat different perspective than the perspective that's out there in the world on fiscal deficits. And specifically, when you can print your money, the only way you run into fiscal problems is if those fiscal problems lead to a currency problem or an inflation problem. I think that's the case. I've read people with alternative viewpoints trying to look through the mechanics of what they're saying. But again, the Fed can get what they want with respect to interest rates. And so there isn't really a problem unless the Fed getting those interest rates lead to outcomes that they can't live with. Those outcomes generally, inflation and currency problems, investment bubbles are another third one, a little bit lower down the list. And so when we look at these deficits, that's the big question that we're dealing with is the disinflationary effect of everything else that's happening in the world big enough to offset ongoing growing budget debt loads? And we're not confident in that, but if you just look at how it's been going, it's been the disinflationary technological implications, for different reasons in the world, you've seen continued progress on inflation. And so the basic picture in our view is while these big budget deficits have shifted up, the sustainable level of real interest rates shifted up inflation and growth rates, they're still in a context of a world that's generally disinflationary. And so that's the thing we'll be looking at is are countries hitting the currency, the inflation constraints? Is the government debt loads affecting productivity in such a way that the limits get closer, right? You look at a country like the UK, they're closer to the limits of fiscal, in part because their debt loads are big, but also because their productivity is so low. They can't grow their way out of these problems. And we'll see how much that rolls into other countries. And that'll be the big question. And of course, against that question, as you know, the other thing that is on my mind and super passionate about is the transformational effect of AI. In Aya Labs, we're playing with all of that technology, utilizing it to build an artificial investor. And I see that we're the progress at such a fast rate to having tremendous impact on Bridgewater, tremendous impact on how you would devise an investment process at this point, and more generally, what that means for white collar work across the US economy. And I think this is coming. The move towards agents is happening. It's a little bit slower than maybe I would have expected a year ago, but it's happening. And I think that that is another big aspect of really squaring the circle here of can you square the circle of US asset prices? In order to do it, you really do need a productivity jump of significant magnitude, which we may be on the cusp of. I think the intelligence is here in many ways. The implications are coming. And I think the bubble's probably ahead of us, not behind us. So those are the big things. You know, that's a long download for you, Jake, but those are the big things on my mind.
That's great. And there's so much there. So let's just drill into a few of those issues that you mentioned. And maybe the first one we can go into is modern mercantilism, because you know it sounds crazy, but it's only been 3 months about since Liberation Day, and we've seen a lot of policy change. But at the same time, despite all that change, and even since the last time we spoke, we're still in what looks like, at least just based on the market reaction, a relatively sanguine environment. So, are you surprised by that? And can investors expect this to continue?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. There's plenty to be surprised about in terms of the reaction of asset markets, how quickly assets were able to pull back despite what is really, if you go back to what was expected in markets in March and where we are today, we've got a lot more tariffs, we've got a lot more uncertainty, we've certainly got a lot more geopolitical conflict, and yet you look at the markets and everything's fine. And make a few observations about that. I mean, first off, honestly, I think it's a gift to client portfolios, getting the opportunity to make adjustments, to get more diversified, to get more resilient. You're in this world, the geopolitical world, we're talking about this with very modest risk premiums in equities. What you've seen over the last couple of months is a risk premium in bonds start to get priced in, the yield curve steepening, the kind of the long-term risk premiums in bonds, still not huge to be clear. You've just had some normalization in the risk premium in bonds, but you haven't seen that in equities. And oftentimes when you see risk premiums enter the bond market, you subsequently see them in the equity market. You've got that on top of having low risk premiums into what is absolutely a risky world. We talk about July 9th. We'll also see as these US tariffs become more permanent, whether the current reaction of the world is sustained, which so far retaliatory tariffs have not been a big deal. That's impressive. Again, if you add that to the list of things that have made asset markets able to bounce back. Now, I think it gets harder as the US policies get more set in stone for there not to be some pushback there in terms of retaliation. And so that's another risk. And the most clear targets of retaliation that could actually hurt the US are US corporations, right? US doesn't export all that much. You can do some retaliatory tariffs, but more likely over time is if the US doesn't allow imports of their goods, it's making it harder for US companies to operate. Now, the US is already taking some defensive measures to prevent that, the 899 stuff in the big, beautiful bill to try to make sure that the US can penalize any country that penalizes any US corporations. Maybe that offsets some of those risks. But we'll see. And certainly, you're entering this unknown period in terms of how the global economy will reset, how other countries will react to these big changes in the US, and what that means for corporate profits and so on. So, yeah, I think we are running into this risk period. You've already seen in my mind the early shifts of the biggest investors in the world. You see that flowing into the dollar. I think over time, that money not flowing into US assets at the same rate will lead to this draining risk that'll increase risk premiums. You know, even just a normalization in risk premiums in the equity market would probably cause a 15-20% down move. You've already seen some, like half of that happen in the bond market. So I think the likelihood that you see that normalization occur in other assets is rising.
So, Greg, I want to just press a little bit more on the and dig a little bit further into what you mentioned on Section 899. That's the provision of the one big beautiful bill that would allow the Treasury Secretary to impose retaliatory taxes on U.S. payments like dividends and interest to foreign entities in countries deemed to have discriminatory taxes. And we've gotten a lot of questions on that. What do you make of those provisions and its effects, you know, particularly for investors who are potentially worried that, you know, their investments may be affected?
Yeah, well, I think this is itself not a huge deal, but the precedent of just continuing down this mercantilist line. And this isn't even one of the Trump administration things. This came up in Congress. And the main point is mercantilism is everywhere. You know, I wrote a Daily Observations now, you know, many months ago now, called We're All Mercantilists Now. And you're seeing this everywhere, right? So now, in order to say, how do you prevent other countries from retaliating for the US in terms of mercantilism? Well, what do? More mercantilism, which is that you end up with this rule saying that, hey, if anybody tries to tax our companies or discriminate against our companies, we'll discriminate against them. And that's what 899 is about. Now, the Senate's watering it down a bit. It probably won't go into effect into 2027. And we'll see how much it's used because it is a dangerous tool for US asset markets, basically raising this question around when you invest in the US, can you count on the rules, or will there all of a sudden be different forms of, let's say, capital taxation, capital theft, and capital controls when you start talking about saying, okay, we'll just get a hit dividends on an investment that was made without the assumption of these taxes, that you could hit those dividends and other payments with a 15% tax. All of a sudden, you need a further risk premium to hold US assets. Now, I think the bill itself will be watered down, may not be that big a deal, but you are seeing US policymakers willing to cross lines that they were unlikely to before. And in the end, I think this is the global point, is that mercantilism begets mercantilism. One reaction causes another action, causes another reaction. And it's very, very hard. And certainly with the Trump administration, very unlikely you're going to get out of that cycle. So what you're seeing instead is the US trying to out-mercantilist everybody else by threatening market access, threatening these taxes to prevent other countries from taking their own steps. But overall, the US is so dependent on financial investment from the rest of the world. And one part of that, the reason the US has been able to attract so much is stable rulemaking. We're clearly, you know, crossing the line to not very stable rulemaking and the potential for rules that really hurt foreign investors in the US to be made fairly quickly has grown at a high rate. And I think you're going to see in many ways the reaction in the capital flows to that.
Let's go back to some of your comments around the economy and the Fed's reaction function. You mentioned the Fed being stuck because of uncertainty around how tariffs and even some of the fiscal policy will affect the inflation picture at the same time that we're seeing some risk to growth. One nuance I want to ask you about is that Powell's term runs out in May 2026. So that's not that far away. And Trump will be appointing his successor. And one can imagine, based on President Trump's past statements, that he'll select someone, you know, a little more predisposed toward easier policy. How are you thinking about the type of person who might be picked? And then also whether having that kind of easing bias might be risky versus not risky for the economy, considering the potential for upward inflationary pressure?
I think what you should expect is a policymaker who will want to maintain Fed independence, but at the same time will come in with an easing bias, significant easing bias. And when you look at the world today, certainly if you look at it through the lens of an easing bias, there's an argument to be made. There's a case to be made. Inflation pre-tariffs was falling, and clearly so. And if you didn't have this tariff kind of overhang, the Fed would probably be lowering rates here. And on top of that, many people will make the argument, could make the argument that whatever implications the tariffs have on inflation will be transient, best looked at like a VAT. And so you have a economy that's not running too hot with inflation coming back towards target. Let's get back on the normalization train and ease. And I think you're going to see central banker more likely to be interpreting the circumstances that way coming in near the halfway point of next year. So the market's got to start pricing that in as well.
And just on inflation, let me just ask you very directly, from your perspective, how concerned should investors be about inflationary risk today? How should they process that?
These are the things I'd say we know, which is one, there is a huge force via technology towards global disinflation that's been playing out. Second, that could still be offset, like meaning if mechanically, if fiscal policy is reckless enough, you will offset it. Now, is this new bill that reckless? I don't know. When we net it with tariffs, we think probably not, but you're at the edge of that. And if you then had a tariff inflation coming post the COVID inflation and a Fed easing into that, this question of the Fed that follows, is it possible that this leads to an ongoing inflation problem? Yes, definitely possible. Is it the most likely outcome? Probably not. But I still think most investors don't have enough inflation protection, probably would be well served by staring at what their inflation protection is. It is dangerous into this geopolitical world, a dividing world with tariffs, and maybe a central bank that'll look past that tariff inflation. That is the type of situation, a bit like the 70s, where the Fed looked at the oil shock and said the oil shock will come and go, and they remained easy, and they set off a set of inflation expectations and changed the inflation landscape in a significant way. So I'd say that's not our central expectation, but it is certainly possible, and we still think inflation protection is cheap relative to the risks.
When we think about fiscal sustainability, something you've talked about here, one of the questions is the one that you've hit, which is, you know, inflation, its impact on economic conditions. There's another aspect of it that of these large deficits that gets a lot of attention, which is the supply of debt that then needs to be absorbed by the private sector. And we've seen throughout the year, there's been numerous cases of bond market sell-offs that followed big fiscal developments. Can you share just how you're thinking about the bond supply picture, both in terms of the impact on fiscal, but also the impact of QT in the US and elsewhere?
Yeah, well, mainly the main QT that matters right now is in the rest of the world, in Europe, in Japan. That right now, I'd say the way I look at the bond market and the reason it's having trouble equilibrating is there isn't nearly as much liquidity in the world into a world with big issuance and big government deficits. And so you're having a little bit of a trouble getting the supply and demand to match. Now, that's the picture today. Those higher rates are starting to have economic implications that will likely change policy. And you're already starting to see policymakers think about the technical things they're doing, where they're issuing on the curve and QT type issues that we think will moderate some of that supply-demand mismatch, because there's a lot of it that is simple technical policy choice. And so you're starting to see that play out, right? And that in Japan, in the UK, discussion of where to issue on the curve, discussion of how much QT is appropriate at this point. Those things are starting to happen. And certainly the bond market itself, if it continues to sell off and term premiums continue to rise, you'll see more of those adjustments. And in the US, you're seeing, despite the criticism of Yellen sort of shifting around on the curve, you see, as you often do when faced with the trade-offs, the Treasury also thinking about the optimal places to issue on the curve and not creating too much supply in this current environment. And so you're seeing actually, despite growing budget deficits, actual issuance remaining the same. And so more issuance on the short end, less issuance on the long end over time. And so I think you're going to see continuation of those policies where basically pulling those technical levers to keep duration issuance from getting too high, more issuance on the short end, which creates some long-term structural risk in exchange for some short-term relief in the term premium.
I want to ask maybe a bit of a broader question, which is how should investors be thinking about treasuries and bonds and the U.S. bonds and U.S. debt in their portfolio? Because you have the various dynamics that you mentioned in terms of the supply, the deficits, the fiscal sustainability aspect. And then there's the question of capital moving out of the U.S. and the U.S. dollar. So let me just ask you the question very directly. Are bonds in trouble? Should this be something investors should be potentially more concerned about holding, or is it more nuanced than that?
Well, I'd say both. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, and it's a risky environment for U.S. treasuries in particular, particularly if you're holding them unhedged in dollars, right? Because that's just forward dollars, and there's a lot of pressure on forward dollars. Whether that'll manifest in more currency depreciation or higher interest rates, either way, there's a big pressure there. And so to me, there's a lot to worry about. And at the same time, I don't think the talk of like an imminent major debt problem in the U.S. is right, because unless it's a major inflation problem, the Fed can handle it. We'll see. Growth is slowing. There is a lot of disinflation. The Fed can and will lower rates if those things manifest. And most portfolios actually are so equity-based that we think it's a mistake to be so scared of bonds that you put all your money in equities. And so overall, I'd say the most important thing is build resilient portfolios that are prepared for a dollar decline, prepared for inflation, that aren't so highly overexposed to equities and U.S. equities in particular.
One last question to sort of tie this all together. You've had the opportunity to talk to many of our clients one-on-one in recent months about some of these very same risks and dynamics and the implications for managing money. Could you share what to you are some of the big takeaways or main points of advice from those conversations in terms of how you see this environment as a money manager and really what to do about it?
Yeah, well, I think the conversations mostly have focused on how do you build some resilience, right? That this is a difficult, complicated world. It's likely to be very different than the last 20 years. And what does that mean? Because most portfolios today sort of have just accidentally become so U.S. equity focused because U.S. equities have outperformed all the other assets. They went up unless you rebalance very aggressively, which some clients have, but most investors have not, and in aggregate investors have not. You end up with this U.S. dominated portfolio. So I think most of the conversation is how do you shift? What can you buy, right? I think everybody is nervous about the U.S., but they're also nervous. What do I buy in Europe? Are there any good companies there? What do I buy anywhere, right? And I think that where I'd say most people are starting to settle is, look, a little bit of everything. There's no obvious answer. It's true that there's a lot of reasons why European equities trade at such a discount to U.S. equities, real valid reasons, and same thing across the world. And there's a lot to worry about in Asia and so on. But I think where it comes out is still, you don't want to be as overexposed to the U.S. as you are. Just getting to a more normal level relative to the size of the U.S. market and the size of the U.S. economy and so on are the steps that we're talking about. How to do that in a mix of asset classes, not just in equities, not just in an asset class that's exposed to weaker growth and higher inflation. Those shifts are the shifts that I think make sense. And by and large, as we talked to clients, largely there's agreement on that. It's hard, and those changes happen over a long period of time. People have to go to their boards and change those things. But I do think you're starting to see thoughtful organizations move in the direction of more diversification after coming out of a period. It's very hard to do because basically the last 20 years, diversification hurt you. I do think the changes in the world have reignited the view that actually I need to be more diversified than I have been, more diversified than the portfolio ended up being based on the market movements over the last 20 years.
Great. So I think let's end it there. Greg, thank you so much for joining me and looking forward to the next time.
Thanks, Jake.